Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
It's the 29th day of January. A very good evening to you, and thank you very much for choosing the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb today. My name is Duduzile Ramela, in for Jimmy Muyaha. Here's what to expect. As usual, we're going to kick off the show with our Market Watcher, and this evening we're joined by David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth. We'll also be speaking about the situation in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, taking a look at mineral supply, the entire value chain, and how it works with businesses that operate in areas of conflict. We speak to a new association that has been set to transform South Africa's payment landscape, looking in particular at the underbanked in terms of individuals and businesses in South Africa. We'll be speaking to Lincoln Mali, president of the new association. We're also going to be speaking to Sean Munsey, portfolio manager at Allan Gray, on striking a balance between risk and return, taking a look at various asset classes, among others. And then in our executive lounge feature, because it is a Wednesday, we're going to be speaking to the retired National Police Commissioner, and that is General Ria Piera, who will be telling us about her journey in the world of work. All that and more coming up in a few moments.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Our Market Watcher this evening, David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth, is standing by. David, thank you very much for your time this evening. It would appear that the sun is shining on the markets today, at least.
It is, but there's still a lot of nervousness underneath all of this. You know, on Monday we had DeepSeek, which just rattled markets. I've heard that word, I can't tell you how many times during the last few years, rattled markets. So I'll repeat it.
Please, we didn't hear it the last
everybody.
Time.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's been rattled by it. But, you know, to be honest, I think that's just a normal progression in any technology. And, you know, even today, just digressing slightly, Alibaba came out with another model, which is even better than this one. So here we go. But, I mean, it's caused people to take a step back and think. But I think on top of it, we've got the Fed a little later. Not that there's going to be any surprises, but everybody's going to be looking to what the outlook is for interest rates, how Trump might have affected that. There are so many different views on rate cuts in the U.S., you know, to some extreme cases of 100 points, in other words, 4 times 25 points, to others where there might not be any or one at the most. So a lot of attention will be given to Mr. Powell. And then we've got results coming out, Tesla, Microsoft, who else is coming? I'm trying to think other companies, certainly Apple tomorrow, I think, as well. So a number of tech results, and everybody's on standby. You know, they're all nervous of what we're going to see, how much these companies are spending on artificial intelligence. Is it too much? Did they meet their revenue forecasts? And you know, it's always a difficult time, and one doesn't know what's going to satisfy the market. You never know.
You never know. And you're not expecting any surprises from the Fed, but any surprises from the Reserve Bank, as all eyes will be on Lesitja Ganyaho tomorrow, the governor of the SARB?
I think 25 points. You know, I think this is, we're all hoping for more because the margin is there to reduce rates even further. But I think he's very cautious and he'd just take it one step at a time. So I think what happens after that is still a mystery. there's plenty of scope to bring down more, but we don't know what the future holds on inflation. And oil prices are under pressure. They're coming down. The rand's one of the, you know, is difficult to read. Trump is difficult to read. So, again, you know, we're going to have to hear what the governor's outlook on rates is or on inflation.
Yeah.
But 25 points, but I think that's already in the market. So I doubt whether there'll be any major celebration.
I do wonder, have you been able to take a look at the circular from Barloworld for its recent takeover offer? And what we know about
no,
that.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't. I know that. No, from a point of view, I think that It's quite controversial. I think it's been in the market for some time. So it's going to be interesting to see if anybody objects to this. But I haven't looked at the actual circular. You know, the last time I looked was the last time they published anything on SEN. So anyway, but that's it's sad to see it go, but I don't know. What can we do?
What can we do? So it is said that the RAND has gained after the Democratic Alliance confirmed that it is committed to the government of national unity.
Well, that's also to do with the weaker dollar as well. So you get a combination of those factors. We're all waiting. Dudu, you know, that's one thing. We're not quite sure of our politics as well. We just hope that there is, you know, not concessions, but there is conciliation and that it does what everybody expected to do, because there's a lot riding on this. There's a lot of optimism riding on the government and national unity. So, you know, hopefully from now on, there is, you know, it's just a better outlook from that. I'm struggling to find the word I was looking for.
I understand completely, because I also get flabbergasted by all the developments, because every other day there's something. So we can only be positive, right? And so if we take a look maybe at the situation also in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Nils Backberg in a few moments in terms of the mineral supply chain. But is there anything that we can glean from what is happening there when it comes to the markets? Are we able to, correlate the two?
No, I don't think funny enough, the markets kind of brushed it aside. I don't think there's been any major effect. It's just that this has always been an area of conflict. You know, the Congo, if you wanted to mine in the Congo, you had to take your own army up there just to protect yourselves. It's been a very difficult area, but I think this is ugly. And, you know, when I say ugly, we've lost 13 soldiers. I mean, that's tragic. I know this is when you join the army, this is what the downside could be. But I mean, to lose 13 people, it's awful. And, you know, no one's not sure where this is going to lead to, what's going to happen. There's always been a conflict area. But the markets haven't really reacted to it. Where it is a little more difficult is that it creates certain tensions, you know, between African nations, and South Africa's at the forefront. So I think that's the only thing we're watching. I thought it would get more headlines. You know, I thought there'd be more global here, not at all. And it's so strange that in Africa, you know, Middle East, something flares up. Oh, we all know about it, and, you know, any other part of the world. But Africa just seems to be brushed aside, which is tragic, you know, which is sad. So, I thought there'd be more attention to it.
Yeah. David, you mentioned a little bit earlier on in your answer that if you want to do business there, you have to take your own mini army.
Yes.
I mean, we're hearing that private military is also like putting down their arms, and they cannot cope with what is happening in Goma. But how is it that businesses are able to thrive in areas of conflict? Is it that? Is it that making sure that you've got a little bit of extra money to make sure that you protect your interests?
Well, I wish I could answer that properly, but I mean, I you know, every time we've spoken to people who are mining there, they've certainly got to make sure that they've covered, you know, from a security point of view, because you take people up there who are miners, and their lives are at risk, and getting workers, it's a difficult area, and it's, I don't think this is anything new. You know, the conflict has been there for some time.
Yeah.
Especially on the borders, and I don't know whether this goes back to the time that they decided on the borders or whoever decided on the borders, but there are a lot of still a lot of tensions there. So, but that's miners, you know, that's mining.
Yep.
It's always in areas that are difficult.
Yeah, we're going to speak to Dr. Backberg in a few moments about that. David, did we touch on commodities, gold and oil? What's happening?
You know, that oil's coming down, but I think when the dollar starts to come under pressure, we do see commodity prices pick up. And today was a good day for the miners, but we never know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, that's the problem. So platinum miners were very strong today. They're still trying to find a bottom. You know, by bottom meaning we're still trying to look for a turnaround. And so much has been spoken about commodities and infrastructural development, you know, with new technologies, but nothing seems to be coming through in the prices yet. I was looking at the copper prices, and are still hovering around 9,000. Iron ore slightly better, hoping that China does something and starts to buy again. So, but nothing substantial, you know, no major breakthroughs in commodity prices. The good news from our point of view is that oil prices are under a bit of pressure.
David Shapiro, always a pleasure to speak to you, and thank you very much for your time this evening. Have a good one. David Shapiro is with Sasfin Wealth.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Investors want real returns that beat inflation and help them achieve their long-term goals. To do this successfully, one needs to strike the appropriate balance between risk and return. Join SAFM Market Update this evening at 6:45 as Alan Gray Portfolio Manager Sean Munsey joins the show. He will explain how the firm is thinking about the current risks in the environment and positioning client portfolios for long-term returns. Brought to you by Alan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized FSP.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Let's tell you more about the city of more than 2 million people in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. It is under siege. Goma has come under the hold of M23 rebels who are allegedly backed by Rwanda. And since their takeover, civilians have been displaced as they evacuate. Private military contractors and Congolese soldiers have abandoned arms and fled. The eastern part of the DRC where this is happening is rich with minerals that make, for instance, the phone that may be in your hand right now, the electric vehicle you are driving, or the gold chain on your neck, to mention but a few. Dr. Nils Bakkeberg is the founder and director of Project Blue. He joins us to take a look at the supply chain of minerals in the midst of the conflict. Thank you very much, Doc, for your time this evening. If you speak to anyone from the DRC, they will tell you they've known no peace from the days of Leopold to date. Help us firstly understand how businesses thrive in conflict areas like this one.
Hi, thank you very much for having me here. I mean, firstly, to dig into the DRC and businesses thriving here, I mean, let's focus in on sort of raw material supplies and landscape, right? So these leverage geological heritage, right? So much like South Africa's heritage in gold and diamonds, chrome and manganese, the DRC is rich in a variety of raw materials, as you've mentioned. You know, primarily when we think about the DRC, we know about the copper cobalt belt, the copper belt between Lubumbashi and Kolwezi. But yeah, in the conflict era towards the east, it's, you know, the conflict minerals known as the 3TGs. These are things like tin, tantalum, and tungsten, and gold, as you pointed out, going into a variety of electronics and important parts of the landscape. Well, fundamentally, the DRC and artisanal mining, so we're talking here a lot of small-scale mining, though there are some exceptions to large mines, tin being an example where one of the largest mines globally is based. The BC Tin Mine accounts for significant global proportion. But a lot of this artisanal material finds its way out between the DRC and Rwandan border, and goes across into China and Asia to being converted into its metal form and processed into technology applications. So really, yeah, it's the demand for these electronic systems that require it. And the DRC is what we sometimes call a swing production. So depending on market conditions, when there's ample supply, supply drops down and that reacts to prices. But then when demand is good, this material does start to get sourced quite rapidly and fills a gap in demand. So maybe just pause there as a quick introduction to the situation.
Thank you so much for that context. And so because the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo has been going on for eons, how will the supply chain be disrupted, if at all, or will it be business unusual as usual?
So for, again, I think maybe worth touching on the typical commodities that people think about when they hear the DRC. So starting with copper, as mentioned, this is in the southern part of the country in the copper belt. An interesting landscape itself with regards to east versus west geopolitics and the Lobito corridor taking material to Angola to the west versus either via trucks to Durban or via the Tazara Railway out to China. Fundamentally, the supply chain there does not seem to be at risk with the current issues in the country, though geopolitically, we could see other sort of indirect impacts onto those supply chains if other actions are taken by governments. So the main market's not expected to be significantly impacted there. People, you mentioned electric vehicles. Everyone's quite curious about the DRC's role in lithium. Mm-hmm. Now, lithium, not a major source out of the DRC, again, artisanal material, but that is coming out of these, what they're called as pegmatite type deposits. And these are crucial for your tin, tantalum and tungsten type of material sitting along the whole sort of eastern border from north to south. The geology varies and so does the mineralogy. So the minerals for lithium becomes a little bit rich for early estimates further down to the south. So not a major impact globally, though material that's coming out there has also already been scarce because lithium prices have been so low. Mm. So we don't see an impact there. But fundamentally, when you're looking at tin and tantalum, for example, these will be exceptionally crucial, right? Tantalum goes via that Goma border into Rwanda, and over 40% of global tantalum supply comes from those two countries and from that region. So that will be critically impacted. Though, you know, border closures, if they're, you know, a couple of weeks or so, don't tend to have that global impact. But if it persists, we'll definitely start to see some impacts coming out of this artisanal material. So things like tin, tantalum, and tungsten seeming more critical with regards to the developments right now.
All right. Doc, you may have mentioned it, and I'm sorry if I missed it, but what is tantalum used for?
No, I have not mentioned it. So tantalum is mainly used as a capacitor in circuit boards. So a hard or motherboard or any sort of circuit boards for electronics use capacitors. So it's part of the electronics landscape and a very crucial material. There's not many alternatives. There's ceramic alternatives. But yeah, every electronic equipment spread across the world has probably got a piece of tantalum in it. It's also used in semiconductors as sputtering targets. Semiconductors opens up the whole discussion for Taiwan and a whole nother geopolitical landscape that's, again, crucial to things like AI development, which will require growing demand. Electric vehicles, you know, because everything's, you know, run by a computer and electric vehicles, demand for these electronic materials are really being stretched and stressed, and these supply chains will get another look under the lens.
Doc, I don't even know how to frame this question and to our listeners, so please be patient with me. So the link between all this mining and the humanitarian cost, right? Because millions of people have been displaced internally in the Democratic Republic of Congo and they face an uncertain future. Who needs to do what? I don't know if who needs to do what? What needs to happen in the DRC for at least for the flow of things to even, not even benefit, but for people to just have life, never mind a quality of life?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably a bigger question for what I'm potentially qualified to answer. But, you know, fundamentally, as with any mining district, be it in rural areas, are exceptionally important for the local economics, right? If that value goes away, there's a lot of value for country that goes in. So, yeah, what needs to change is policy, correct support, you know, formalizing the supply chain, right, so that it's not criminalized. These are issues we see in South Africa as well, you know, that are being discussed with our own gold and chrome supply chains. So, yeah, it's a governmental level conversation and then also international, right? We've got different acts coming in that are supporting investments in critical materials, right? Critical materials now, becoming a good buzzword with regards to new technologies. And it's about access to supply and understanding those supply chains and risks to supply, right? The DRC has always been considered a high-risk supply with regards to conflict minerals. But how do you improve that is, yeah, you invest in the infrastructure and support it rather than rip it away, because, as you mentioned, from the humanitarian perspective, you're taking more away than just conflict minerals. There's also livelihoods involved in that. So maybe just to touch on a few points there, I don't think it's a simple conversation.
Yeah.
It's not as simple as cutting off mine supply, because it has other implications.
I really thank you for, I know it's outside of your scope, but for helping us at least find some answers where that is concerned. But I do wonder if you can help us with this then. How long can we continue to mine in the DRC? How sustainable is what is happening? How sustainable is it, yeah?
So the sustainability question, again, is from a risk of supply. If things aren't, if it's considered a conflict mineral, right, there are things in place that will look to replace those. Cobalt, because of its risk of supply, as was deemed by battery manufacturers and their end users, right, the automakers are being asked, where is your material coming from? Can you confirm that material is conflict-free? So there's pressure from that. And what have we seen? We've actually seen battery technologies evolve and thrift out, i.e. replace some of the cobalt in its formulation. Now, cobalt stops lithium ion batteries from exploding. So, you know, there's a reason why it's there. So not a simple thing. And this is why chemical engineers are a very well sought after degree at this point in time. There's lots of work to be done to understand different battery technologies. So, yeah, there are some alternatives that one can be looked at, but fundamentally for things like copper, you know, the DRC is going to be here to stay. Obviously, copper much more. You've got large companies invested in this. You've got Glencore there, CMOC, China Molycorp. So all of the major economies are based there. But then for things like tin and tantalum, yeah, it does need some consolidation to support the local mining. There are alternatives, right? Tantalum can also be sourced from lithium byproducts coming out of Australia. And we've seen Western consumers, the US and EU, look to Australia and North and South America for their lithium controls, whereas China is still investing quite heavily in Africa and supporting that local economy. Obviously, its demand far outweighing that of Europe and USA. Mm. So that really being the major market. Again, quite a broad question. One can go quite philosophical into it, which is what one should do. But if you're just looking at the facts and figures, you know, the tantalum out of the DRC is an important part. And it's going to be difficult to substitute that by going to other places like Australia, where costs are higher. And again, that opens another cost conversation. So it needs investment and it needs support on a much more higher level.
Doc, to your point on alternatives, right? I was reading an article about one of the world's most biggest jewelry makers, and they have chosen the route of going lab grown in terms of their diamonds, right? Are there alternatives like that, for instance, lab grown minerals? Is there such a thing?
I mean, we've grown diamonds. When I say we, that's a royal we. I've definitely not done it myself, but you know, diamonds have been grown in a lab. You can create synthetic materials that are replacing, if you're talking about composites, I mean, look at aircrafts, right? They use super alloys and heavy metal materials and in parts being replaced by composite materials, right? Fiberglass, plastics, all sorts of innovative ways to do things. But for certain other applications, that is less simple to do, right? Okay. And if you're talking jewelry, what is the driving demand market? Well, it's fashion, right? So it is a diamond, whether it's synthetic, as in lab grown, or natural, created by Mother Earth deep underground, is a marketing opportunity between De Beers versus competitors making synthetic diamonds. So those will be different. So jewelry is a different market in the sense that it's a fashion industry, has completely different demand drivers. But when you're talking technologies, like tantalum is also crucial in certain parts of aircraft, right? And you're creating these super alloys that need these metals to allow aircraft engines to operate at certain temperatures. And without them, yeah, air travel would have to change again. So some things are more hard to substitute, but there are some smart chemical engineers out there, and they're definitely trying to do that as much as possible.
Doc, thank you very much for your contribution this evening. Dr. Nils Beckerberg is founder and director of Project Blue.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best Forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
The last quarter of 2024 saw more muted returns from the local equity and bond markets, and we're going to be telling you about that a little bit later on as we speak to Alan Gray about that. But for now, let's tell you about a new association where in many parts of the African continent, the proverbial cash is king, and South Africa is no exception. Many consumers and businesses, more so in the informal sector, are underbanked and rely on cash-only transactions. Now, 8 of the largest non-bank digital payment providers in South Africa aim to change the lives of these consumers and businesses by contributing to an inclusive financial sector for all and progress the digitization of payments in South Africa. And this, they say, will be done through a vehicle called the Association of South African Payment Providers, also known as ASAP, a new association which was launched today. To tell us more about the association, we're joined by its president, Lincoln Miley, Chief Executive Officer of Lesaka Technologies. Thank you very much, sir, for your time this evening. What informed the formation of the association, ASAP?
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us. I think all of us in our own individual capacities and in different organizations have tried to put a case across for financial inclusion in this country. I think we've tried to make the case that our society remains one of the most unequal in the world, and our economy is not growing fast enough to absorb so many people and be able to create opportunities for many people. We've also been making the case individually that we need to change the payments environment to be more inclusive, to be more digital, and be modern. But we felt that if we're doing this in our individual organizations, we will not be as effective. Though we are competitors in a narrow sense, the true competition that we face is inefficiency, is lack of access, is lack of development. So we thought that let's pull all of our resources, intellect, data, experiences together to create a body that becomes the voice for the non-bank participants in the payments environment. And that is why 8 leaders of fintech organizations involved in payments decided to form the Association of South African Payments Providers, which we launched today.
What did your research inform you about why people and businesses remain non-banked and prefer cash?
I think that the issue of cash has to be looked at as both an opportunity and a challenge. A lot of people are still using cash because there are no viable alternatives. If viable alternatives are put on the table and they are cost effective and they make sense, customers will vote with their feet. Let me just give a couple of examples very quickly. If 10, 15 years ago you wanted to send money home, you needed to give it to somebody who gives you a taxi to give it to somebody. Then innovation came that says you can do a cash send. Everybody who's participating in the economy finds some way now of sending cash send. Now, we have PaySup. But PaySup has not got the same traction because its pricing is not right. The people who are participating in PaySup are largely the banks. If you open it up to innovators and disruptors, it will lower the cost and you'll have more transactions that are taking place. Give another example. If I am running a shop in a township or a village, I am likely not to have the ability to take other forms of payments, like QR code, like a card, like mobile money, and all of that. In the future that we all envisage, each person must have the ability to pay with the form factor that they want, and the person on the other side, whether they are a consumer or a merchant, must be able to accept that payment. The last example I'll give you is anybody who does plumbing, or anybody who does gardening or anything, who comes to your home, they now have to wait for you to send them this money. You will send them, let's say, through instant money or any transfer. Then it's in their account. But now, in order for them to make the money work, they now have to draw the money in an ATM as cash. And then they have to find a way of sending that money to the other person, let's say, in the rural areas of KZN or Limpopo or Eastern Cape. That person also now has to draw the money to get it used. Now imagine if you were paying the plumber, the QR code or any other form of payment, and they are immediately sending it to the person in Limpopo, Eastern Cape or KZN, and that person is able to pay whatever merchant that they are dealing with in Limpopo. That money has moved very fast in the economy, and we're able to generate a lot of economic activity. That's the kind of change we're talking about. So we are very happy that the Reserve Bank was at our launch. They've signaled profound changes that they are going to make. And one of the big changes is to enable, through regulation, through some exemptions, for non-bank players like the Aid of Us and others to be able to settle and clear without requiring a bank. In today's payments environment, you have to be sponsored by a bank, or you have to go through an entire elaborate process to be designated. We're saying that's not leveling the playing fields. Enable non-bank players to participate, and you will see the change, as has happened in India, as has happened in Brazil, Southeast Asia, and other environments. Once you open up the payments ecosystem and modernize it, make it inclusive, you will see innovation, you will see growth in volumes of small transactions, but the benefit is to a larger society.
Okay. You mentioned the word pricing a little bit earlier on. I think one of the reasons why one of the major banks in the country, which came much later on as a player, managed to be successful more so in the beginning is because people had the perception that they have lower costs, whether you're withdrawing money or whether you're sending money. When you're transacting with them, the banking costs are not as much. So when it comes to this, what is the pricing? When you speak of a plumber, they will be concerned that of this 100 rand, must I take out 10 rand so I can send this money to Limpopo, or must I take out 20 rand so I can send this money to wherever else in the country?
That's exactly the two things the regulators have indicated that they're working on. The first one is they have PaySup, and they have indicated that they want PaySup to be as cost-effective or as free as possible to the end user. That's what they're working on. So they are creating a payments utility where they will say anybody who wants to use this utility cannot simply just charge what they want. They must make it more cost-effective to the end user so that more people will use that. The same way you've used the analogy of that bank, people move from other banks to that bank because they the perception or reality that the costs were lower. So if people see PaySup as being cheaper and more effective, people will move and do their transfers through PaySup, and that's important. The second part is they've indicated to us that they are having a review of interchange, and interchange is important in setting, what the price levels are in making sure that people are able to do digital payments. And again, as I said upfront, if people see viable alternatives, which are cost effective, they will be able to see those as part of an extension. This is not a fight against cash. This is about putting viable alternatives that people can use, because there are parts where cash makes sense for many communities, but there are lots of things where cash is actually, very prohibitive. It's very frustrating. It doesn't enable a lot of the economy to grow as fast as it can.
Thank you very much, sir, for your time this evening. Lincoln Miley, president of the newly launched Association of South African Payment Providers.
Eduvos applications are still open for 2025. Step into a brighter future with South Africa's leading private higher education institution. With over 20 accredited qualifications, internationally recognized, flexible study options, and 12 campuses nationwide, Eduvos prepares you for the careers of tomorrow. Study on campus, online, or distance. Your future starts at Eduvos. Visit eduvos.com and enroll today. Eduvos, your education, your future.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
This segment is brought to you by Alan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. Now, the last quarter of 2024 saw more muted returns from the local equity and bond markets as they digested the outcomes of the U.S. presidential election back in November and the latest actions from the central banks, all while concerns regarding growth prospects in the world's largest economies persisted. Globally, equity markets fared similarly, with the exception of the United States, where the benchmark indices have continued to hit fresh all-time highs. Now, as the world continues to process numerous geopolitical shifts, more conservative investors who want to generate long-term returns ahead of cash and preserve capital in the short term have to consider many factors to strike an appropriate balance between risk and return. Sean Munsey is portfolio manager at Alan Gray, and he joins us rather on SAFM Market Update to explore the environment and the considerations investors need to weigh up. Thank you very much, Sean, for your time this evening. So we look at domestic equities, global equities, government bonds. How did these various asset classes perform in Q4 of 2024?
Thanks, Dudu, and thanks for having me on your show. Yeah, so as you mentioned in the intro, while a lot happened in SA during 2024, the last quarter was probably more defined by what happened in the US, and particularly the outcome of the US elections in November. And then December, we had a meeting of the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, where they put out a forecast for rates going into 2025 that came in quite a bit higher than what the market expectation was at the time. So going into the year end, returns fared less well than perhaps they would have in the past. That being said, although SA equities was down about 2%, In the fourth quarter, the year to date, the yearly return for 2024 was still very good, at about 13.4% for our all share index. And I mean, that's the best return we've seen since that post COVID bounce in 2021. A lot of that driven on the back of the SA election results, and I guess the market welcoming the formation of the GNU or coalition government. Nowhere was that more obvious than the performance of our SA government bonds, where the All Bond Index returned around about 17-odd% for the year. So from a local asset perspective, it was a good year. But as you mentioned, really from a global investor standpoint, while SA did well, The US was the standout market. So the S&P 500, the benchmark index in that market, returning in the sort of high 20% in dollars, which is clearly an extremely high return.
Hmm. You mentioned interest rates. For the more conservative investor, how do you generate returns given the rate cutting cycle?
Yeah, so I guess very topical question, given that tonight we've got the US Fed is meeting, and I guess the expectation is for them to hold rates, which is, a departure from what we saw for the latter part of last year, when, if you remember, they did that big 50 basis point cut and followed by 225 basis points cuts. That being said, I guess our Reserve Bank is meeting at the moment, and we'll get the outcome of that meeting tomorrow, where the market expectation is for 25 basis points cut. So I think given where repo is and where the inflation prints have come over the last few months, clearly inflation remains well controlled in South Africa. So while we are in the midst of a rate cutting cycle locally, our expectation is that it's probably going to be shallower than perhaps some of the cycles in the past. So I think the current forecasts are for a further 50 basis points of cuts over 2025. And given where inflation is, that's still a decent real return for the more conservative investor. I guess less good news if you're a borrower.
Sure, absolutely. Let's take a look at this. And I'm not laughing because of it's funny, but I can definitely relate. So it's not good news if you're a borrower. Let's stay with the conservative investor, right, and talk about the benefits of a low equity multi-asset strategy for investors with less appetite for risk.
Yeah, so I guess when you think of a low equity multi-asset strategy, the investment classes or tools at your disposal is cash, as we've been speaking about, bonds and equities, and you can invest across those asset classes both locally and offshore. So as I mentioned, on the local side, real returns, so cash returns after inflation, still remain attractive. And bonds even more so. If you think sort of 10-year bond rates in SA are north of 10% versus inflation in and around the threes at the moment, although I guess the expectation is that inflation will rise into the remainder of the year, that's still generating a healthy real return. And I think the beauty of the low equity fund, such as the Allan Gray Stable Fund, is this allocation to equity. So up to 40% of the fund can be invested in equities, and that's very much seen as something that can be flexed given the opportunity set. So while within the local context, we're still finding a decent value in some SA counters. I guess on the offshore context, that's where things get slightly more interesting, where, as we said at the start, the US has been extremely strong, and some other global equity markets have sort of been left by the wayside. So I think the low equity multi-asset strategy sort of gives access to various asset classes where attractive opportunities exist.
Okay. As we look into 2025, maybe you can tell us about the headwinds for the South African investor.
Yeah, so I think 2024, on the local asset front, a lot of it was driven by sentiment. And nowhere was that more obvious than in SA government bonds, where I guess from an investor viewpoint, some of the tail risks of lending to the government were diminished to some degree, and we saw our yields come down strongly. And then a lot of that was sort of reflected within local equities off the back of that. I guess as the discount rate that investors place on shares and companies exposed to the local economy comes down, that boosts the share pricing. The share prices, so you get a nice re-rating. I think the challenges for a lot of our local companies going into 2025 is that base is now higher. When it went to 2024, I guess expectations were probably below normal. At the moment, expectations have been reset higher, so it's probably up to these companies to justify that re-rating. So it'll be interesting to see how our local banks and retailers and insurers fare in that regard. I guess on the other pockets of our local equity market, I think resources is quite interesting at the moment, because that was the one sector which lagged in 2024. Clearly, returns in that sector are premised less on what happens in SA and more global factors in terms of macro and commodity pricing. And I guess there the big story was China and the continued ills within the residential property market. So that's something to keep an eye on. To the degree some of those headwinds in the property market persist, it could be a tough year. But you'll be familiar with some of the stimulus measures that the government there is trying to roll out to instill some confidence back into the markets. And then I guess on the offshore side, similarly to SA, where the base has reset higher, nowhere is that more obvious than in the US. And I guess the returns we've seen in January to date from some of those high-flying US names and the news that came out earlier this week about AI models coming out of China and what that's meant for some of the US tech stocks, I think that makes things quite interesting going into 2025, given that a lot of those shares and have been the driver of global equity returns over the last few years.
Sean, thank you very much for your time this evening. Sean Munsey is a portfolio manager at Allan Gray. This segment was brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized FSP.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Right, it's time now for our Executive Lounge feature, which we do every Wednesday here on SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. And this evening, it's a great pleasure to be in conversation with General Mangwashi Victoria, also known to you and I as Maria Pierre, an experienced past senior executive in both the public and private sector. Having served in various executive positions, she is currently the Chief Executive Officer of the Women's Development Business Trust, which provides social services, training, and developmental microlending to women facing trying circumstances. General Pierre is on the line and joins us to let us in, May, on your journey navigating the world of work. Tobela.
Good afternoon, Dudu, and thank you very much for inviting me to MoneyWeb.
Thank you for honoring our invite. When you were first introduced to the public was when you were made the first ever female police commissioner of South Africa some 12, 13 years ago. Take us back to when you were in school, if you will. What did you want to be when you were growing up? Do you remember?
Yes, I do. But perhaps before I take you back there, I just want to say to you, as a retired woman leader, I'm doing two things. You've mentioned the first one, that I'm the CEO of WDB Trust. I am also the CEO of an organization called Safer South Africa Foundation. So I'm splitting my time between the two organizations, helping them to continue and advance development of our country. Let me then deal with what you've asked me. You know, many years ago, one day I was with my father in a car, and he was driving around. And at that point in time, as I was growing, there were very few women who were driving cars. And on this day, we saw a woman driving a Beetle, white Beetle, with the registration GG. I was so impressed and struck by that. And I asked my father, who is this woman and what does she do? And my father said to me, she is Mrs. Chweu and she is a social worker. You know, that thing stayed with me for a long time, because I said social worker, significance, woman driving a car. So I was so impressed. And this whole thing of being a social worker stuck to my mind. When I finished at college and I went to the university, the first program I looked for was this social worker, because my father had explained to me what you study to be a social worker. But for me, that thing of saying, I saw a woman of significance, a woman driving a car. So I just said, she must be doing something important in society. And I want to be that type of woman. And that is how I got into social work.
So this is what they mean when they say representation matters. You had something or someone to look up to.
Yes. And I also, the whole issue of I'm a people's person. And I think somewhere else it resonated with the spiritual gift I had of just working with people.
How long had you been a social worker before we were introduced to you when you took up the position of the National Police Commissioner?
I worked as a social worker for about 7 years when I finished after graduating at the university. I worked at Pretoria Child Welfare as a social worker. And those 7 years before I finished them, I was promoted to lead a branch of Pretoria Child Welfare in Atteridgeville. And during that time, I was approached by UNISA. They piloted a very beautiful program, and I loved it. We became a center of training young social workers who were at the university, giving them practical work experience. Before I opened my eyes, many universities were reaching out to say, what are you doing with those students that we see being so significant? And our center grew. We even built extra, you know, infrastructure to start being a center that is training, giving practical work training to social workers. So after the 7 years, an opportunity came for me to join the private sector. I then joined the Chamber of Mines. At that point in time, the Chamber of Mines, which is an association that assists the mining houses, was setting up what we call an employee well-being center. Okay. So I became part of that group.
Okay.
That piloted setting up an employee well-being center, which was serving employees in the various mining houses. It was a different setup, but it was still helping people, but in a corporate setting.
Okay.
So we would service those mines. And then the National Council for Child Welfare came back to me to say, you know what, we are setting up, we have been focusing a lot on counseling and adoption and foster care. But very clearly, and that was in the late 80s, early 90s, because at that point in time, I think our government or our country was starting to realize that you cannot counsel people out of poverty. You need to give people development, empowerment, and all that. So when I was recruited to come and be one of their first directors to set up community development services within the child welfare movement. And
okay.
that was working with something like 240 child welfare organizations, and the IDT was being set up. So we started doing a lot of development work.
Okay. Then we transitioned from social work to the South African Police Services. Let's just take a listen to what we heard when you were made the National Police Commissioner some 13 years ago. This is what you said during a press briefing.
I have never been a police. And I do want to say you don't need to be a drunkard to own a bottle store.
I guess your work of being a social worker, transitioning to being the National Commissioner of the Police, wasn't such a far-off idea. But what informed you then moving to that sector?
Between my being a social worker, I spent a lot of time in corporate. I was in Transnet as a group executive. I was in the maritime environment where I was in the Ports Authority as an executive. I had worked at APSA as an executive in the corporate affairs space in all these areas.
Mm-hmm.
So I had gained a lot of skills as a general manager in the NG Civil Society Center in corporate. So all I was saying with that comment is that I am having a toolkit of general management, and I am bringing it back into, you know, the public sector. And with general management skills to do, all you have to do is to say, what is this, the industry and you can apply those skills, you know, almost automatically. That is what I was meaning with that, to say I am a seasoned general manager. And the other thing that I need to mention is that, you know, when I was approached to do this work, I did ask a question to the president. I said, "President, why would you even ask me to come and do this? Because I'm not a police person." And he said to me, "I have looked at your CV. I'm not looking for a police. Police people, the police service is not short of police skills, but the police service is short of good administration skills, good management skills, good governance. And a DG of a department is about that." So this is what gave me confidence that with the skill set that I've had, I would be able to do the work.
And that is our executive lounge feature with the former retired National Commissioner of the South African Police Services, Rea Pierra. If you missed any of our conversations, you are most welcome to head on over to our website. That is www.moneyweb.co.za. Thank you very much for choosing the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. Have yourselves a magic evening further. Bagaitsho, bulakio.